Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Today, the book doctors are in the house, and we'll hear the story of a young Nigerian immigrant studying psychiatry in New York City who has recently broken up with his girlfriend. He winds up spending most of his time dreamily walking around Manhattan. The book is Open City by Teju Cole. We have lots more, too, in a visit later today from Victor Wishna with another installment of his Fans Notes. The book doctors are Steve Paul, senior writer at The Star and the newspaper's book editor. Stephen, good morning.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having me back.
Freelance writer, editor, and reviewer Jeffrey Ann Gowdy. Jeff, good to have you.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having us.
Grace Suh is back. She's a writer and editor. Grace, good morning to you.
Good morning.
And finally, Katie Stover with the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library. Katie, good morning to you.
Happy to be here.
Well, how's the book world these days, Stephen?
Well, it is, in turmoil like everything else, although, you've got all sorts of things happening. I think I heard a teaser referencing The Hunger Games, and I guess, if you're not writing a sequel to The Hunger Games, then you pretty much are sucking wind. But beyond that, it's amazing. We all brought books in that are worth reading, and they're all in hard copy, and, they're not going away anytime soon.
The world's still alive.
Yeah, we are.
Well, Katie, why don't you start? Pick out one there and tell us what you brought us here today.
Oh, well, I brought The Scrapbook of Frankie Pratt. It's by Caroline Preston. She wrote Jackie by Josie. I read this a couple of years ago and liked it very much. Mm-hmm. But this is a complete departure. It's a novel in pictures, and I love illustrated novels. Jack Finney, love Time and Again.
That's a new trend, isn't it?
I don't know that it's new, but it's one that never seems to go away. Every once in a while, it seems like every couple of years, an author decides to do something interesting with pictures and text. Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children. Chris Bojalian did it a couple of years ago. There's always one, and then you expect all these other authors to jump on the illustrated novel bandwagon, and nobody does. I don't think it's that easy to do. I really think you need to have a very creative idea. And what Caroline Preston does is she has her own collection of vintage ephemera, and she takes that and she uses the pictures to tell the story. She doesn't just take the text and have it illustrate the pictures illustrate parts of the text. The text enhances the pictures. So it really is a scrapbook, and it starts with a young woman in New Hampshire right after her high school graduation. She's accepted to Vassar College, and she doesn't have the money to go, so she takes a post as an assistant to an elderly woman in town. And becomes involved with the elderly woman's recently discharged son from the army. Oh, and I forgot to mention that I say vintage. The story opens in 1920 and it will conclude in 1928. So it covers the Jazz Age. But
I'm just looking at the pages you're flipping through there.
Yeah.
This is not a conventional book by any stretch.
No.
This is something very different. Yeah,
very different. And someone could finish this in an hour, a speedy reader. You'll want to spend more time than that looking at all the maps, the seed catalogs, the picture postcards, scraps of fabric. It's a little newspaper bits. It's amazing what Caroline Preston has kept and put together, these various things to tell one story, to tell the story of this young woman's coming of age. Hmm. And Frankie Pratt does manage to get to Vassar, where she meets Edna St. Vincent Millay and becomes enamored of literature. She wants to be a writer. And then she takes herself to Paris, and she goes over on the Mauritania, where she's hanging out with a couple of displaced Russian princes and gets involved with them. Then she's in Paris, living above Shakespeare and Company, helps James Joyce edit the better bits of Finnegan's Wake. And then she finally goes back home to New Hampshire. It's all about Paris in the Jazz Age, America in the Jazz Age. And it's a fun, innocent, whimsical book. And it would be really sentimental and sweet, just something you could throw away, except that you really do see Frankie's progression from young girl to young woman in this book.
The Scrapbook of Frankie Pratt.
I have a question, Katie. How is it different from a graphic novel? You call it a novel with pictures.
Right. It is different from a graphic novel. I've read a number of graphic novels, although I can see why someone would call this a graphic novel. I would say it's different because the pictures are telling more of the story than the text. However, without some of the text, you wouldn't be able to completely understand what's going on. And while that does happen with a graphic novel, those two pieces work together. Almost, they balance together, those the text and the pictures.
And the visuals are collaged as opposed to drawn like
yes.
a
Yes, right,
like
I see. Comic, this yeah. is just, although I have seen some graphic novels that do that too. Mm-hmm. This seems to fall into the category more of illustrated novel. It's really hard to articulate what the difference is, except that this is a novel in pictures, not a graphic novel.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Interesting.
All right. Grace, hi.
Hi.
What you got?
Well, I brought a stack of literary fiction because that's what I tend to read. And I have to say that the one that I was most skeptical about.
I live in that world, Grace.
Thank you.
I've been there a million times. Yeah.
Is the one that I enjoyed the most. And I was... so, dare I say the word again, so skeptical about it that I didn't read it until a couple of weeks ago, and it came out about 18 months ago. Has anybody else read A Visit from the Goon Squad?
A Visit from the Goon Squad by Jennifer Egan.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I really thought that it was one of those books that was overhyped, and I kept my distance from it. And I had read several excerpts from it in The New Yorker and in Granta, and I thought they were really good, so I finally made myself read it. And it is one of my favorite books that I've read this year.
Wow.
It sounds like everything I wouldn't want to read. It's about a disaffected young assistant and her music industry boss who lives a very dissipated lifestyle. And it sounded like all the makings of one of those kind of hedonistic, cynical, nihilistic novels by... you know, it could be by anybody, by Volman or Bret Easton Ellis or Jonathan Franzen, a book that kind of skewers its subjects.
Mm-hmm.
And yet it's not. It's just so – it's really brilliantly written. It's a series of short stories, and I had heard that, you know, it can't really get away as a novel because it's a series of short stories. I don't know if you felt they worked together, Steve, but I've – felt that it really worked completely together as a novel.
Even though there are a series of short stories.
Yes, and each short story is from the point of view of a completely different character.
Wow.
Who only kind of randomly connect with each other. You know, so one story will mention just in passing this man's son. And then two stories later, the story is from that man's son's point of view. But they really resonate, and I never questioned it, that it was a novel. It never felt like a short story collection. It felt like a novel to me.
Wow.
And the writing, you know, as literary fiction, it's so hard to describe on the radio. It's not high concept like historical fiction or graphic novel. It really hinges on the language. But the language is just wonderful. She's a really great writer, and she got the Pulitzer. And she deserved it. It was really good. It's a beautifully written, really masterful.
Hmm. A Visit from the Goon Squad by Jennifer Egan.
Yes.
Sounds good.
I've read about the book, and there's some wild plot element, right?
There are some. You know, there was a lot of attention paid to the fact that there is a PowerPoint presentation.
Oh, that's right.
Two-thirds of the way through the book. And I think that... the book can sound gimmicky. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of attention was paid to these gimmicks. The fact that it is all this series of short stories, and that you know, you have these characters who do drugs and steal, and it sounds like a movie. It sounds like a movie you wouldn't necessarily want to go see, but it's actually. It's actually very soulful.
But just to pull something like this off, to attempt something like this, sounds like a real leap of faith.
It is. It's a very ambitious novel. And in fact, I think this book came up a lot when there has been a lot of talk lately about the fact that women's novels don't get the same kind of critical attention mm-hmm. that books by men do. And this book is the book that has been held up by a lot of people as saying, you know, Jennifer Egan is a writer who is every bit as ambitious, every bit as technically daring.
Yeah.
And I think it's absolutely true. She absolutely pulls it off. But in addition, I think that it is a book that examines the inner life and existential questions as much as 20th century novels do. And I think that's something that's missing for me from someone like Fullman or, you know, someone who's just talking about dissipation or just trying to see how much he can shock you.
Wow, you just sold me. That's on my list. That sounds sounds terrific. Yeah,
has a PowerPoint. It's an illustrated novel.
Jeff.
Okay, good. The first book that I brought in is Running the Rift by Naomi Benaron, I think is how you pronounce her name. And it is the winner of the most recent Bellwether Prize for Socially Engaged Fiction. And that is a prize that was founded and funded by Barbara Kingsolver. And this is set in Rwanda during the time of the Rwandan genocide. The hero is a really winning character, Jean Patrick. When we first meet him, he's running the hills, the green hills of Rwanda. And his father is a really gentle person who has shielded him from the growing friction between the Hutus and the Tutsis. And he has, in fact, been taught that there's no difference between the Hutus and the Tutsis. And he is about to get a rude awakening. His father dies in a vehicular accident, and things start spinning out of control. He gets kind of attacked by some Hutu boys. And after the death of his father, the mother takes the family to live with the uncle, who's a fisherman. And this is a novel really about prejudice and about the way we're taught certain beliefs. And so initially, ironically, he and his brother Roger are very prejudiced about their uncle, who's the fisherman. But in fact, their uncle is very politically sophisticated. So he is a runner, and he is in school one day when an Olympic runner comes to visit his school, and he wins a race, and he decides to become an Olympian. And he qualifies for an elite school and comes under the training of a coach known simply as Coach, who is a Hutu. And he talks him into taking a fake ID card that's a Hutu card. And Jean-Patrick feels really bad about that, but his uncle says, go ahead and take it. That won't change anything. But this quickly becomes unnecessary because the powers that be decide that it would look really good for a Tutsi to win the Olympics. And pretty soon, everything spirals out of control. There's a systematic violence that occurs. 800,000 Tutsis were estimated to have died in the genocide. And the novel really asks the question, can you pursue a narrow personal goal, however noble, in the midst of this embroiled political situation? And the answer in this book is no, you can't.
Wow.
Benaron has worked with genocide survivors from Rwanda, both inside and outside the country. She's listened to hours and hours and hours of stories. And I think that this book is she's trying to bear witness and kind of render what happens so that perhaps it will not ever happen
again. This is an author who knows what she's talking about.
Yeah, and it's a debut novel, and it's not completely artistically written, but it's very compellingly written. And so, and despite the fact that it's describing these brutal circumstances, it has a country that's beautiful, very gentle characters, and I would definitely recommend it.
Running the Rift.
Running the Rift, yeah.
If you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR, and we're talking with our book doctors about all manner of new books. If you have a good recommendation for us, 816-235-2888, our email address, uptodate@kcur.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page. Dr. Steve Paul is in the house.
Well,
step up to the plate.
All right,
take a
here
swing.
We go. Take a swing at this. I love short books. I've been reading short novels lately, and they still take me a week or two to get through, given everything else that's going on. But I'm here to talk about a really fine novel called Open City by Teju Cole, which you mentioned
introduced
at the
show
top,
with,
top of the show. This book just won the Hemingway Foundation Pen Award for First Fiction. It's the first novel. That award handed out last weekend in Boston. Teju Cole is a Nigerian who came to this country in the early 90s, and his book happens to be about a Nigerian who, unlike the author, is a psychiatry resident in New York City, but came to the country also in the 90s. And the character, Julius, spends much of the book wandering around New York, getting in touch with the city, getting in touch with himself. There's a little bit of insularity about this book in that you spend a lot of time in his head. As he moves around, as he encounters other people, as he kind of reflects on his own life in Nigeria, goes back and forth in time, takes a vacation to Brussels, which is also referred to as the open city. You begin to wonder, well, where is this book going? Mm-hmm. And after a while, there is a revelation deep into the book that makes you realize that Julius has a lot of stuff on his mind that he has forgotten. And I'm not going to talk about that incident or what comes to light, but a person from his past confronts him about something that he did that was not all that morally correct, and it's something he apparently had forgotten about. And so as you discover who Julius is, he has a mentor who's dying. His mother was German. His father was Nigerian. He has a lot of identity issues he's kind of, again, reflecting on. This is a book about solitude. It's about self-awareness. It's about insularity.
You got hooked on it how? I mean, how did you come across
it? Well, I it was getting a lot of buzz. I mean, as Grace was talking about, you know, books that are hyped, it was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award recently. It certainly got some major review attention towards the end of the last year. Just came out in paperback. And so, you know, it's one of those books that is on the radar. I only read it recently when I learned it was the winner of the Hemingway Pen Award. And I was taken with it. I love that kind of. I mean, clearly, Teju Cole is a wonderful writer. It's very cleanly written. It's very literate. There are literary allusions. Julius is always kind of reflecting on literature, on music. He's a very smart and intelligent and culturally aware kind of person. He's just not totally aware of who he is. And that's one of the dynamics of the book.
That's Open City by Teju Cole. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Grace, yeah.
Well, the really interesting thing about this guy, Teju Cole, is he's a young man. Mm-hmm. And I haven't read his book, mm-hmm. Open City, but I'm familiar with him because he has a very famous Twitter stream. And for those of us who are part of the Twitter generation, he has an amazing number of followers, and he has a Twitter stream called, I think it's called Small Fates.
That sounds right. Yeah.
And it kind of, I think he makes them up, but they're supposed to be headlines from African newspapers. Mm. And apparently they would have these, where he grew up, these small stories where an entire person's life was encapsulated in you know, basically a Twitter length.
Wow.
Kind of headline.
140 characters.
Yes. And so he does this stream. I can read you a couple. I have them because I follow him.
Yeah.
Here's one. A blow to the head did Johnson, 32, no apparent damage. But 9 hours later at the Turkish Baths, 42nd Street, darkness claimed him.
Wow.
And so he writes this Twitter stream. And so it's kind of funny because – you know, there's a lot of talk these days about literary fiction and the fact that it is there still an audience mm-hmm. for literary fiction, especially among younger people. And so Teju Cole has done this thing where he has this Twitter stream and is probably reaching, you know, I think his stream has maybe 25,000, 30,000 followers. And as we all know here in the book industry, 10,000 copies is a lot to sell for a literary book. And so he's reaching a lot more people through Twitter.
He is an interesting guy. I met him last weekend, and he is an art historian. You wouldn't expect that, his specialty being Dutch art. But he's also a photographer. Mm-hmm. He showed me some of his pictures. He takes what he described as street photography, kind of, spur of the moment, highly composed, but really interesting pictures of urban scapes and people and that sort of thing. And he said he's got a big show going to be in India later this year that he's working on, exhibit of his photographs.
You mentioned you came mm-hmm. across this book. Are there other sort of big books, fiction, nonfiction, coming out in the months to come that the four of you are sort of poised and ready to pounce on, that getting buzz, getting attention, whatever, as we move through 2012?
Well, depending on how you feel about Richard Ford, he's got a big novel coming out. I don't always look forward to his novels, but he is someone that we do contend with.
Yeah, Katie, anything that you're anxiously awaiting here?
I was at PLA last month and the Public Librarians Association, and everyone, it turned into a mosh pit of librarians trying to grab the latest from Deborah Harkness, the latest galley, Shadow of Night. And that's the follow-up to her debut novel, Discovery of Witches, last year. And that was it's an amalgam of genres. It's fantasy, it's science fiction, it's historical fiction, it's romance, it's literary. This academic writer has thrown all of that into the pot, and readers have been clamoring for the second in this very thick trilogy.
Well, I know Robert Caro has the fifth installment of his LBJ biographical series coming, which has people like me just absolutely frothing in anticipation here. Jeff, anything across your
mind? I'm looking forward to The Age of Miracles, which is a piece of eco-fiction about the Earth. Earth's rotation slowing down. And apparently, even though, I mean, that sounds like it's typical sci-fi speculative fiction, it is written in very precise language, a real literary gem. Yeah. Also looking
Who's the author?
I can't remember. Okay. I knew you were going to ask that.
Sorry.
Also looking forward to Laura Moriarty's The Chaperone, which is historical fiction that's coming out. She teaches at KU Creative Writing, and it's about the story of the chaperone to Louise Brooks, who is leaving Wichita, going to New York City to make a big splash, and it follows her, and it's in the 20s. And so it has some regional interest as well.
So many books, so little time. Yeah, absolutely. Katie Stover, what do you have next up there?
Oh, I brought a book that I know Steve can talk about as well, The Submission by Amy Waldman. She was up for that prize.
She was a finalist for the Hemingway Pen Award as well, yeah.
And I came to late last year, and I listened to it, but I've just been so in love with this book. It's quietly compelling, it's thought-provoking, and it's about the committee that chooses the memorial for the 9/11 site. And it takes place 1 year after 9/11. This special committee of artists, politicians, fundraisers, and one woman who represents the families come together to choose the design, the anonymously submitted design for the memorial. It's based on fact. Apparently there was a real committee that did this, and there was a little bit of controversy when the architect's name was revealed.
I remember that, sure.
And what Amy Waldman does in the submission is she takes it a little bit further, and after the committee fights and agrees on a design for the 9/11 memorial, the artist architect is revealed to be a Muslim American, and this causes ripples in the media. The committee doesn't know if they can back this design now that they know who the architect is. And then the arguments, do you back the design? Do you back the designer? And the governor of the state is calling an open forum where the public can weigh in on this. And there's an artist on the panel that doesn't think the public should be weighing in on something like this. There's one quote, there's a reason we don't have all the firefighters in New York choosing this memorial. They'll have a giant helmet in downtown Manhattan. and that seems rather, that is, it's funny. It's sad. Every one of these characters has flaws, and yet you understand their point of view. You support them. By turns, you support them, and you're a little put off by them for their beliefs, but you understand why they all feel the way they do. And it's not until you get to the very end of the novel where Amy Waldman pulls off the threads of all these different characters, the brother of a fallen hero, the politician, the widow, pulls these threads together, and you understand the wrong they could have done the architect for not supporting his art And you also understand the architect's strength of will and what this incident did for his career. Hmm. It's amazing. It's poignant. It's extremely thought-provoking. It's a very careful balance of wit and philosophy. It's powerful. It's extremely discussable. I was telling Laura before I came in, bring this one to your book group.
Wow.
And one of my book groups will be reading it this year. A lot to discuss.
It's all that. It's got the title, The Submission.
The Submission by Amy Waldman.
Wow, sounds great.
Now, which is a title that has multiple meanings, of course.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And she was a New York Times bureau chief or something. She's a journalist,
journalist. She was the co-chief of the South Asia Bureau for the Times.
Wow.
And this is her first novel.
Lots of first novels here
so
today.
So impressed with the writing. It's elegant, it's compelling, and it's moving. The whole story is moving.
Well, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our good conversation here with our book doctors, and we'll turn to a whole bunch of other new books, and we'll get a submission from a Fan's Notes by Victor Wishna later on this hour as well. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And welcome back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed yesterday's conversation about the legacy of artist Thomas Hart Benton, and speaking of good books, the new bio of Thomas Hart Benton, you'll find that in our weekend to-do list at kcur.org. Monday on the program, a look at the issues of designing a city, plus a conversation with Rachel Maddow. This hour, we're visiting with the book doctors. They are Steve Paul, Jeffrey Ann Gowdy, Grace Suh, and Katie Stover. Next up, Jeff. You have the floor.
Yeah, okay. I brought a collection of short stories here by Chris Lee called Drifting House. I reviewed all three of the books I brought in today, but for the Kansas City Star. Mm-hmm. And Chris Lee was born in Seoul, South Korea, and was educated in the United States in London, and she presently divides her time between Seoul and San Francisco. This book just took my breath away. It was written with such precision and such beauty. Mm. But the interesting thing is it tackles some really dark subjects. Her writing reminded me of Jhumpa Lahiri in terms of capturing split cultural identity that the immigrant faces. But also, I think even more, she reminded me of Alice Munro and her willingness to really tackle really dark and taboo subjects. That said, my favorite story was a light story, one of the lighter stories at the edge of the world about a character named Mark. He's living with his parents in sort of a concrete Korea town in Los Angeles. His father is really grieving because he's left his family behind in North Korea. His mother, as much as his father is stuck in the past, his mother is all about denying the past. And Mark is whipping around in a little velvet cape, the superhero. He's a gifted kid. He knows all these random facts, and he sort of represents the future and the hope for a less encumbered future. Another story that I really loved was The Goose Father, which is about a lonely accountant in Seoul, who is supporting his wife and children in Boston, and he takes in a male roommate, and he's a real buttoned-down, really repressed guy, and he falls in love with the male roommate, finds love in an unexpected place, and he's sort of the young guy is really open, and he's really closed, and it was actually a very beautiful story. She actually takes on, like I said, some very, very dark and taboo subjects, incest, murder, but she writes about them with real precision. But I think that my favorite stories of hers are not about the real highs or the real lows and the brutality, but the way that she sort of captures just moments of epiphany in daily life, where we're sort of lifted out of our brutal circumstances. There's a lot of violence in this book. Have you read?
I've read some of the stories.
Yeah, you were nodding your head.
Yeah,
I've
read The Goose Father, and I've read a couple of others.
Did you like The Goose Father?
I did. I think it's really interesting because I used to volunteer with the Korean American Family Services Center in New York, and I think that in the Korean American community, there's a lot of a lot is taboo. And mental illness and discussions of mental illness are taboo. I mean, we just know, we just heard about that shooting in Oakland a couple of days ago. And so it's really interesting that that Chris is starting to write about these communities about which I think there's lacking some insight in the larger culture about what's going on in the Korean-American culture. It's kind of this, you know, maybe the obverse of the model minority myth. And so, yeah, I think she writes really beautifully.
Yeah. And apparently she has a novel coming out next year as well.
That book, again, is The Drifting House. And we were talking during the break about finding time to read. Grace, when do you find time to read? I mean, for me, it's a chronic issue. It just never goes away. What about you?
Oh, it's always the last thing at night.
Yeah.
You know, you put your weary head to bed and pick up your book for another 10 pages. I think that's what most of us are like.
Katie, when you work for the library, do you have a chance to actually read as part of your job, or does the world not work that way?
That is not part of my job description.
Yeah, okay. You can't go there.
Librarian at work, reading.
I could. I don't have time. I get up about an hour early every morning and brew a big pot of coffee, and I'll read. And I can, in the morning, I can put away about 50 pages. That's the only time of day when I can do that. So I will purposely set the alarm and read for about 45 minutes to an hour, and I can get a lot done then, especially when I have to get something read. But at night, Grace, I hear you. If you can get through 10 pages, that's awesome. I can't. I'll start to fall asleep.
Me too. Well,
and Steve Paul, you're constantly looking at your BlackBerry. You have 4 or 5 events a night. How do you find time?
Yeah, I do the late night reading thing. I do the late night reading thing, and I read a lot on the weekends. And so I just fill up as much time as I can. I carry books around on my phone, so if I've got a moment waiting for something, I can read a book or read pieces of a book. In the little downtime.
Yeah. Grace, what do you have next on your list there?
Well, speaking of the Asian American experience, I brought The Buddha in the Attic by Julie Otsuka. Mm-hmm. And she's a Japanese American writer, and this is a very small book. You'll like this, Steve.
Yeah, I know. Yeah,
it's 120 pages, and it's a very small trim size. So it's I'd say it's maybe 50,000 words max. And it just won the Penn Faulkner Award for Fiction. This is her second novel, and it's written in a very interesting voice. The first person plural, we, and it's the collective voice, almost a Greek chorus, of picture brides. And if you remember from history, picture brides are Japanese American women who were matched up with Japanese women who were matched up with Japanese American men via pictures. And then they would ride the boat over from Japan and meet their husbands here and begin their new lives.
Man, what a concept.
It is a crazy concept, especially, there are these really interesting photos. I've seen historical photos taken on Angel Island in San Francisco when they arrived. Yeah. And you see these women in their kimonos standing next to these American immigration officials. And of course, a lot of times they would arrive to find that the man in the picture is not their husband to be, or is their husband to be 20 years ago,
exactly.
And now he's an old man. And
meaning
they had misrepresented themselves. But
it happens out there in the romance world.
Exactly,
doesn't it?
Same thing that happens on Match.com these days.
Yeah.
And so it tells their collective story, and this collective voice continues throughout. You never hear, individual characters, but you hear different strains. And so you'll hear, my husband was kind to me. My husband, being my husband, was not who he said. And it follows them from their from the trip to their arrival in the United States, and then all their various fates. And so some go to work in the farm industry. Mm-hmm. In Northern California and Central California, which for a long time was almost dominated by Japanese farmers. Mm. And some go to Japantown, and some go to various, brothels and whatever their individual fates turned out to be. But then the culmination of that is World War II and the executive order that puts them all into the internment camps, and that's how the book ends.
It's just amazing to me, that idea, the idea of those trains that used to go across the Midwest and the orphan trains. Mm. The kids would get off the train, mm-hmm. and the farmers would come out, rural folks, and pick, I just can't hardly get my arms around those ideas and how your life changes on a dime at a moment like that. And you know it's going to change on a dime.
Yeah.
You can see the thing coming at you, So.
And this is not so long ago.
Not so long ago.
This is very recent. I know if you remember from Star Trek, Captain Sulu George Takei just recently revealed that he grew up in one of these internment camps during World War II.
Yeah.
And so these are people that we know and people that we see. And, you know, this is our, I guess, maybe our grandparents' generation when all of this happened.
Yeah. You know, I read that book also, and I thought it was absolutely seamless the way she worked in her historical research and personalize that collective voice.
Absolutely.
The title of that book again, Grace, is?
It's called The Buddha in the Attic.
The Buddha in the Attic. Okay.
It's really beautiful.
Steve Paul.
Well, I brought in a book that I think I – stop me if you've heard this before, but I think I brought this in the last couple of times I was here and never got around to talking about it. But let's hope this will be somewhat new. This is a novel by a young man named Ben Lerner, who's originally from Topeka, whose family still lives there, who Jeff knows very well. This is his first novel. He was a poet. He's done about 3 books of poetry. This novel is called Leaving the Atocha Station, and ta-da, it's about a poet. But it's about a poet on a fellowship in Madrid and who's not having a very good time because he's a little befuddled why he's questioning his own talent. He considers himself a fraud as a poet. He's not sure what he's doing and why he's there. He bumbles through some affairs. His writing is not going well, and he really, again, questions his role in the world as an artist. I would say he spends a lot of his time in a kind of stoner sloth or lassitude, and you know, one of his girlfriends is a translator who's translating his poetry, and kind of leads up to a big reading at a gallery that he's really nervous about, and anyway, all this sort of kind of casual life of a young American in Madrid is happening, and where the title comes from, and where the kind of one of the major dramatic moments of the book is the train explosion, the train station explosion. In the Atocha station, one of the major Madrid train stations. And key to kind of Adam Gordon's character is that when, as a poet, when that happens and he sees and hears and a lot of people running in the street and chaos happening, what does he do? He doesn't go and check it out, but he goes back to his room and gets on the internet and starts kind of surfing news sites, tries to figure out what's going on, as opposed to kind of doing the real life experience of. Anyway, so that tells you a little bit about him. There is a period of growth and knowledge and poetry that kind of arrives in his life toward the end of the book and. You know, one of the things that attracts me to this is not only that it's a short novel, under 200 pages, it's wonderfully written. You can tell the writer Ben Lerner is a poet. There's some turns of phrases. There's some long loping kind of undulating sentences that work very well, and in a way, there's a lot of poetry embedded in this book. So I've been recommending it a lot lately. It is like Buddha in the Attic. It is a finalist for an LA Times Book Prize. It comes out, I think, later this month or will be announced later this month.
And that's Leaving the Atocha Station by Ben Lerner.
Yes. Also a finalist for the Literary Lions Award in New York City.
Yeah. Let's go to some phone calls here. Tam from Kansas City, Missouri. Tam, good morning. Hi, Tam. You there?
Oh, hi.
Hi.
I'm sorry. I didn't think I'd get on this fast. This is off the subject of Asian American, but Steve, you mentioned orphan trains, and
yes.
I wanted to tell you that Linda Lale Miller, who's a famous Western writer, wrote a series of books, 3 books, about the orphan trains. The main characters are 3 girls whose mother in Chicago put them on an orphan train right after the Civil War, because her new boyfriend who was a soldier, didn't want them. And it's about what happens to them. One is called Carolyn and the Raider. One is called Lily and the Major. And the other one is Emma and the Captain, I think. And I may have those slightly confused, but Linda Lale Miller does a wonderful job of Western writing. And I was fascinated by this subject because I'd never seen it written about before in novels. So
yeah.
I thought I'd just mention those.
Hey, so. Tim, I'm really glad you did. Thanks for the phone call. Okay?
There's a local writer named Andrea Warren who's written a book about orphan trains for younger readers. And
that's been out
for quite a while. You've probably talked to her about it.
Yeah. We just have a few minutes left. Let's do another round, but just bite-size, quick ones. Katie Stover, why don't you run here?
Oh, for the 100th anniversary of the Titanic, I brought an historical novel about the Titanic called The Dressmaker by Kate Alcott. And it's as much about dressmaking as it is about the Titanic. But it opens up with an apprentice to a well-known designer. The apprentice's name is Tess, and she gets brought under the wing of Lady Duff Gordon while they're on the Titanic. And, of course, we know where the story is going. Boat sinks. Tess.
Did it really?
Yeah.
Is that what happened?
Oh, Steve. Read the news.
Slow down here a little bit for me, Katie. Yeah.
Boat sinks, but people engage in pretty horrific behavior while boat is sinking and they are escaping. That includes Lady Gordon. Tess escapes, but she gets on the good person's boat with unsinkable Molly Brown. So they save as many people as they can. Lady Gordon's boat doesn't save anybody, and Lady Gordon winds up in front of a panel investigating.
Oh, wow.
All of this. So the last third of the book draws very heavily on the actual transcripts from those hearings.
And the title of that book again is?
The Dressmaker by Kate Alcott.
Okay. Jeff?
Just very briefly, Guilty Pleasure Department here, The Red Book by Deborah Kopakken Kogan.
By who?
Yeah. It treats a reunion. And I personally think that a reunion is a little dicey subject to base a novel on. I think people kind of regress at reunions, and people do regress at this reunion, and there's a lot of bed hopping here.
By regress, you mean people
regress to their earlier behavior, yes.
Yeah.
And there's the most admirable character in the book at one point thinks to herself, I think I may be the last monogamous standing. But despite that, there is some froth here. But what I really liked about the book is that the author actually started the book when her husband had lost his job, her father had died, and they had to move to a more affordable neighborhood. And there's lots of economic hardship here and references to economic hardship. And the writing is smart. I found myself snatches of the book kept coming to me several days after I read it, even though I felt guilty that I liked it.
Yeah, Grace?
Well, speaking of economic hardship, I brought here a short story collection for people who like short stories. It's called Stay Awake by Dan Shaun, which is spelled C-H-A-O-N. And I'd say that he's on a kind of a lineage from Ray Carver to Dennis Johnson, working class heroes, the kind of people you read about in the news who – you know, leave their kids in the car and their kid dies. I mean, people who live hapless lives and make bad mistakes. There's suicide, accidental death, maiming, a lot of intoxication. But it's kind of the real lives behind these kind of desperate stories.
And that book again is?
It's Stay Awake by Dan Shaun.
Yeah. Steve, Paul, you got a...
I like Dan Shaun's last novel, whose name is escaping me right now.
Await Your Reply.
Thank you, Await Your Reply, which
had a
kind of global thriller aspect to it. It was pretty nice. I'm going to do something completely different and speak up to the bookstore moment that we feel like is, you know, we're losing so much of. And this is why, you know, I happen to be in a bookstore. I happen to see this book. And at this moment in time, I must read it. And so
I love those moments.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so I picked up the book called Molecular Gastronomy, Exploring the Science of Flavor by a French writer named Hervé Thys, spelled T-H-I-S. And it's a wonderful book. It's about 3 or 4 years old. It's a book about the science of food and cooking, and it answers, the important questions like, will your coffee cool off faster if you stir it or blow on it? And so it's a lovely book, great science, and
that
great
title
fun.
Again is
Molecular Gastronomy, Exploring the Science of Flavor.
Well, I want to thank you all for coming in today. What a great conversation. Steve, Paul, Jeffrey Ann Gowdy, Grace, and Katie Stover, thank you all very much.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you.